from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is Sex in the City, we know from HBO. But what about families? The welcome revitalization of urban America in recent years has meant an influx of young people, a jump in housing prices, a surge in nightlife. But when singles couple and, well, have a couple of kids, many are moving out, and with them go urban children. This hour on Point, what it means when America's hottest cities are, increasingly, cities without kids. But first, we begin tonight with news on a shifting economy. The markets were closed today for Good Friday, but earlier this week, the Federal Reserve Board bumped interest rates up another 0.25%. And for the first time in more than 4 years, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan warned of inflation. Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him what's got the Fed worried.
Tom, I think the Fed has finally, after maybe 3 or 4 years, finally switched its focus of concern to inflationary pressures. Let's recap for a minute. From 2001 to 2002, their main concern was that the economy was in recession and then struggling to come out of recession. In 2003, for a time, they were actually worried about deflation, that is, falling prices. For the last year, we've been kind of in a sweet spot where inflation was not too high or not too low. Now, finally, you're hearing a significant shift in tone from them. They're worried about inflation going a little bit too high, and the implications are pretty serious. We could have bigger and faster rate increases than we'd been expecting.
That is, interest rate increases. Where does it stand now compared to where it was, Greg?
With their move this week, the Federal Reserve has only raised their short-term interest rate target to 2.75%. Now, it was 1% about a year ago, which was the lowest we'd had in about 40 years. But still, even at 2.75%, that's historically quite low, and there's a lot of experts out there who believe that a more normal level would be somewhere between 3 and 5.5%. I think what the Fed is trying to tell us this week is that it's going to go a lot higher before they're done.
And how quickly could the Fed move to that higher level?
Well, so far they've only gone at a quarter point per meeting, and they have a meeting about every 6 to 8 weeks. And they've told us that they do intend to keep going gradually, that is to say a quarter point per meeting. But I think there's definitely a risk out there that given their increased concern about inflation, that they could give us a half a point move in the coming months. But for people out there who have to worry about their borrowing costs, it's not so much whether or not the Fed will go a quarter or a half a point they have to care about, but how are the markets going to react? Because it's the markets that set the rates on things they care about, like mortgages and home equity lines of credit and so on. And those rates have also moved up sharply in anticipation of this much more hawkish position from the Fed.
Well, Greg, describe in kind of real-world terms what it would mean for people if it went to 3% or 5.5%, more normal historical levels.
Well, I think it would mean two things, Tom. First of all, this has been really a paradise for borrowers for the last few years. We've had an extremely low cost of borrowing. Mortgage rates have been close to their lowest level since the 60s and 70s, and we've seen the result of that in extraordinarily strong demand for houses and housing prices. I think as interest rates move up, we'll see some of that strength come off, probably a little bit of erosion in housing prices and much lower levels of activity. So not such a great environment for borrowers. But for savers, I think it's finally going to be a little bit more rewarding. I mean, people, especially on fixed incomes, have had to suffer under like rock-bottom certificate of deposit rates and money market fund rates for years now. And finally, they're starting to get a little bit of a more return. Still not much compared to what they got back in the 80s and 90s, but certainly a little bit better than they had last year.
What appears to be driving the inflation, Greg?
There's a number of factors behind the inflation picture, Tom. One is, of course, the thing that everybody knows about, which is higher oil prices. And normally we wouldn't worry if it was just oil prices because over time, you know, that we get used to that and we'd go back to the pace of inflation we had before. But there are now signs that the higher oil prices are working their way into other things, such as fuel prices, even things that use petrochemicals like insecticides, tents, even Barbie dolls that are manufactured in China. Other commodity prices like steel and copper are also very high. And also, the growth in productivity, which is basically a measure of how efficient the business sector is, it's not as good as it's been for some years. That means we need to hire more people to get the same increase in sales. That's going to cost more money, and those costs will be passed on in the form of prices.
Now, what about the inflation kind of growth relationship? How's economic growth doing? If inflation's coming on, what about wages? What about growth?
You raise a very good question because we're used to associating higher inflation with very strong growth. And in fact, the economy has been very strong. A lot of people think that the economy will grow at a 4% rate in the current quarter. oddly enough, that has not yet translated into really strong wage increases for the average worker. In fact, wages are still lagging behind inflation. But we've seen the unemployment rate come down fairly steadily in the last year or two. Most of the forecasts are that the job market will gather strength this year. I think the prospects are good that wages will start to catch up with inflation and perhaps pass inflation later on this year.
So on balance, if you're an American, sort of a typical household income sitting out there tonight listening to this news about inflation and interest rates, what's the response? Is this good news, bad news, not clear yet?
Tom, I think overall it's actually good news. I mean, what the Fed has basically said is we're on the case. Look, there's some signs there that prices are going up, and if we don't act, that could put an end to the very benign environment for inflation that we've had for the last few years. But the Fed, as a central bank, considers it its sacred duty not to let that happen. That may require significantly higher interest rates in the future. It's not necessarily the case that that's going to tank the economy, but it will put an end to some of the extraordinary benefits that some people have enjoyed over the last few years, such as those in the housing market. But I wouldn't characterize this as bad news or things falling apart. I think I'd characterize it more as returning to more of a normal situation. And the bottom line is that if the Fed is successful and that it does stabilize inflation, that's probably the best contribution it can make to making sure that the economy continues to be strong and doesn't fall back into recession anytime soon.
A change in the climate toward normal. Greg Ipp, thanks very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. It was a great idea. Fix up the cities, put in snazzy restaurants, refurbish beautiful old housing stock. If you renew it, they will come. And they have, in droves. Young singles craving excitement and opportunity have helped populate newly vibrant urban neighborhoods in recent years. So have, increasingly, well-heeled retirees. But there's something missing from broad swaths of the new urban fabric, and it's children. Families are packing up baby... packing up when baby makes three or four or more, and there are consequences. This hour on Point, Cities Without Kids and the New Urban Life in America. You can join the conversation. Is your neighborhood part of the celebrated rebirth of the American city? Is it celebrating children? Have you tried to raise a family in an up-and-coming American city? Does it work today? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Seattle is Timothy Egan. He is roaming national correspondent for the New York Times. His article, headlined Vibrant Cities Missing One Thing, Children, appeared in yesterday's Times. Timothy Egan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
So you looked around the country. You found all these hot cities that were just shy on kids. And how far shy of historical norms, Timothy?
Well, they're well below the rate of replacing themselves, the so-called replacement rate, meaning that, you know, these cities would eventually supposedly die out at the rate that they're having their children right now. But, of course, they're getting immigrants and inflow from other people, so they're not dying out. They're also well below the national average, too. The national average is about 25% of the population, and these cities are anywhere from a low of 14%, San Francisco being the most childless of all cities in the U.S., to these other cities, the top 10, all being around 20% or below.
Take us on through that top 10 or some of them, these brimming cities that aren't brimming with kids. What cities are on the list?
Well, this is what's fascinating about this thing, Tom, because you know, I did a series a couple of years ago about the death of small-town America in the Great Plains, and in those places they were doing everything to get kids there, offering homestead acts, and just nobody wanted to live there was why. There's no economy, no jobs. But these are the most vibrant, forward-looking, action-packed, positive, attractive cities, mid-sized cities in America. They're Boston, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Austin, Atlanta, Denver, Honolulu, Minneapolis. I mean, these are these cities that draw educated, well-heeled, either like the demographic dream for city managers who want to bring them in. So they're these very healthy cities in every single way. If you look at housing prices, if you look at tax base, if you look at reinvestment, if you look at how they support the arts, I mean, just across the board, they have everything, and parks is another thing, they have everything going for them except for one thing, Their children are dying out. They're falling. They're just gradually diminishing, going down, down, down.
Dying out, meaning, I mean, not that they're dying. They're just not showing up in the population, but the populations
exactly.
are growing.
So they're all, what's happening as a result of that is, are a couple of things. I mean, all these cities are closing their schools right now. In Portland, where I based the story, when I was there a few weeks ago, they announced six schools closing. And this, by the way, is a city that really supports its public schools. Something like 85% of all child-age families attend public schools in Portland.
And still, you report that even though their population is up, they now have the fewest students in more than 80 years. Who has moved in to populate these cities as families with kids have fallen off the radar?
Well, it's not just your stereotypical, prototypical, you know, so-called dink, dual-income, no-kids or yuppie couple. It's interesting. They're empty nesters. And there's another thing going on here, too. As home prices rise and people see the value of it, people are not turning over their houses. I heard of a phenomenon called aging in place, where basically people are staying put in some of these cities after their kids leave rather than go retire to Sun City and turn it over.
So well-heeled retirees sticking right where they are. What's the consequence? I mean, I can imagine some people saying, it hurt me, I had to leave the city. Others saying, well, I live here. Yes, I guess there aren't kids, but who cares?
Yeah, people say that, but, you know, I didn't really hear that. Maybe it was because people are not open about that. But interestingly, these cities still do support their school levies and things like that. And I was really hard-pressed. I mean, I walked around this Pearl neighborhood, and I went to places like Scottsdale, which is also experiencing this very...
In Arizona.
Very upscale suburb in Arizona. And you don't hear anyone say, it's great we've lost all the kids now. I mean, this is terrific.
No more spitballs. There's a loss of diversity of fabric and, in a sense, of kids who grow up as urban dwellers who understand the city in their bones.
Exactly. And, you know, people say that it goes to a constituency that will support trails and parks and schools. And I mean, it just makes you... Charles Roy, the ex-mayor of Seattle, made a very good point. He said, when you have kids around, you really are forced to think about tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. Tim Egan, you've put us on to this. We appreciate your opening our eyes to it. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Timothy Egan with the New York Times. We're talking about cities without kids in a new era of urban revival. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about cities without kids in a new era of urban revival and what it means when the hottest new neighborhoods in the country are nearly child-free. You can join the conversation tonight. Is your neighborhood part of the rebirth of the American city? Are there children on the streets of your revitalized urban neighborhood? Have you tried to raise a family in an up-and-coming American city? Did it work? Or did you flee? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's turn to Portland, Oregon right now. We're joined from Portland by Gary Blackmer. He's city auditor in Portland. He's conducted a survey recently of Portland families who left the city to find out the reasons behind their exodus. Gary Blackmer, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here I'm looking at your statistics. 1960, Portland schools had 80,000 kids enrolled. Today, with about the same population, about 45,000 kids enrolled. That sounds like a vanishing population of children.
It is, and we think there are two major factors that drive it. One is, as you talked earlier, the young pioneers coming in and moving into affordable housing that they can afford with at the beginning of a career. And I think what they end up doing is displacing the lower-income families who move out into the next ring of lower-income, lower-cost housing. So that displacement's happening. And once they get there in their housing, they realize that it may not be big enough for their family. And when children are in their clear plans, they start looking to move out to the suburbs.
Gary, I wonder, can you actually feel it when you're walking around Portland, Oregon? Do you have the sense of, oh, my gosh, where are the youngins? Is it that evident?
It goes in waves. The neighborhood I moved into 30 years ago had almost no children, and there were a lot of retirees. There have been young professionals moving in. Some of them stay with their children, but we have one house down the street we call the incubator house because a couple moves in, they have a baby, they realize it's not big enough, and then they move away.
And the chicks hatch and they're gone.
Exactly.
So you talk to families who left, and tell us what's driving this. I mean, in many cities, a generation or less ago, it was all about the schools. Is that still the top issue?
Not at all. The number one factor that was cited, three-quarters of them said, was housing, that they were looking for a bigger house, They were looking for more bedrooms. The second factor was safety and security. About a third of them cited that. The next factor, about a third, said they were looking for a better neighborhood. And only about a quarter cited schools.
So how is the city responding to this, Gary? Is it seen as a big problem? Are you making efforts to bring families with children back into the city? What do you assess as the impact of a low child population in Portland?
Well, what we see, at least what I heard talking to parents, was that the elementary school catchment areas, as we call them, the area that the children live in that are served by a single elementary school, really becomes almost village-like, that parents bond with other parents through after-school sessions, you know, listening to concerts and things, and the children become lifelong friends as they grow up together. So that's something that I think families really want to preserve here. And when a school closes, suddenly those friendships are split up and children get sent to other elementary schools. So there are a lot of strategies that we're looking at and we've tried over time. One of them that I think is pretty neat is we have a website that's called housingconnections.org.
What does it do?
What it does is it connects families up with housing in that same school district. So if they want to keep their kids in the same elementary school, they can look for, in this case, affordable housing that allows them to keep their kids with the same teacher in the same classroom.
So you're trying to keep them there, but it's clearly, from the numbers, not an easy thing. The Portland school population dropped by almost half since 1960. Gary Blackmer, stand by if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation Nicholas Retsinas. He's director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University, author of Opportunity and Progress, a bipartisan platform for national housing policy. He joins us tonight from Providence, Rhode Island. Nicholas Retsinas, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
What's going on? What's the big picture here, the big ebb and flow of American urban populations that this is figuring into?
Well, I think if we look at the whole United States population, we have interesting changes both in household types and the numbers of people at different ages. Let me just give you a couple of facts to set a context. 50 years ago, 9 out of every 10 households in the United States had 2 or more people. Today, 1 in 4 is a single person.
Mm-hmm.
The fastest growing household type in the United States are empty nesters, and the second fastest are single-person households. So there are just generally fewer children. Now, there is an exception to that, which is those communities that are gateway communities for large immigrant populations.
Mm-hmm. New York, I would assume.
New York, Boston, Los Angeles, all of those have lots of children. They just don't. They are just not the conventional sort of families that we think of. They're very, very different families that come from all over the world and settle in these communities.
I'm hearing this both ways tonight, but it looks to me like, I mean, the last time we really paid attention, all the conversation was about everybody leaving the cities, the sort of decentralization of American life. In the last few years, a lot of talk about people going back to the cities, but we're hearing tonight, young people, retirees, the influx, at least at some tiers of the economy, not that much to do with families.
Well, I think it's easy to overstate. We have just concluded literally a century of suburbanization and decentralization, and the facts are pretty clear. That decentralization continues. However, there are categories of people that find urban living very attractive. We call them, glibly if I may, the not-yet-wed and the not-yet-dead.
Okay.
The sort of young people and the older people. But as the previous participant said, it's pretty clear also when some of those people begin to have families, whether it is the cost of housing or the schools, they are joining that suburbanization trail.
What do you see as the consequences, Nick Retsinas? If this happens, does it matter for the city, or can the city just go right on drawing in, you know, the young strivers and the well-heeled retirees, and thank you very much, no problem?
Well, I think there will be consequences. In certain cities, you'll have much more of a bifurcation. You'll have poorer people of color, many of whom are immigrants, will live in certain neighborhoods. And in pockets in certain cities around the country, you'll have these situations of sort of young people or empty nesters. It really will not be a community. It'll be a series of very distinct neighborhoods that have very little to do with each other. and very little of a sense of an overall community.
So that sense of loss of the community. I want to welcome one more voice into this conversation from Miami. Robin Backen joins us. She's Associate Professor of History at the University of Miami, serves on the Board of Directors of the Urban History Association and the Society for American City and Regional Planning History. She's former Assistant Director at the Scholl Center for Family and Community History, author of Building the South Side, Urban Space and Civic Culture in Chicago. Robin Backen, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We've got a little different angle from every voice we've heard on the show tonight, Robin. Do you see this same kind of disappearing child in the revitalizing American city?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think what the previous guest suggested is that much of the revitalization is happening in particular areas of the city and is attracting particular segments of the population. So, for example, in Miami, we have a massive explosion of high-rise condominium development in areas of the city that, say, 10, 15 years ago were, you know, considered dangerous and seedy and whatnot. But the kinds of people that that attracts, particularly here in Miami, are often people who are extraordinarily wealthy, first of all.
Right.
But also people who might be transient. Miami itself is a very transient city. There are a lot of people from Latin America, for example, who might make the city their second home. So oftentimes, it's not even that it's just not about families or not about children, but it's also about serving a kind of transient population. And one of the larger issues, which is one that Nicholas just raised, is this issue of a kind of lack of sense of community and the kind of bifurcation in terms of neighborhood, in terms of race and class and ethnicity that he discussed.
Kids knit the city together, and if there aren't as many, there's just less knitting going on. I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation, if I may. Sabrina is calling from Boston. Hi, Sabrina. You're on the air.
Hi. My husband and I live in Boston South End. That's,
okay.
Again, one of these neighborhoods that's faced a revival.
Trendy, gentrifying, up-and-coming, all
very
that buzz.
Much so. Mm-hmm. And we have a little 18-month-old child.
Congratulations.
And when we first moved here, we were amazed to see how many parents just like us live here, and we weren't expecting to find that. And in fact, we even have a Yahoo chat group that addresses all kinds of urban issues, like what strollers to buy for Boston's cobblestone sidewalks.
So you've got plenty of conversation going on about the
right.
munchkins, but what about when they turn, I don't know, 5, 6, head to school? Is it still there?
Exactly. We're discovering some of the downsides. We've been thinking about schools, and if you can't afford to send your kids to public school, to private schools, it's very difficult to continue to live in the city.
So what's the plan? Are you going to join the flight to the suburbs? Is that it?
Well, we hate the thought of doing that, but we're thinking actually of moving to another city where the cost of living might be a little lower than Boston. But some other downsides also that we've discovered are that it's been a tough winter. You know, it's hard to keep a toddler entertained in a little two-bedroom condo.
Right.
And also, it can be really unaffordable when families start to get larger. I mean, we're having a hard time thinking of how we can afford to buy a three-bedroom place or a four-bedroom place if we may need that in the future.
And we know what those prices have been like.
Issues.
Yep, we hear it. Sabrina, thank you very much for your story. Nicholas Ritsinas, what about the housing stock and housing prices and the size of available housing? Is there a shortage of family-sized housing in these cities, or is it just unaffordable?
There really is a shortage in certain markets and certain neighborhoods. It's interesting to hear that caller. 40 years ago, we had this concept of starter homes. They're often in the cities or on the inner ring suburbs around the cities, and these were small homes. Attached single-family homes, often in neighborhoods of those homes, that could be modified over time to accommodate children. Today, when we build homes, we don't build them for first-time home buyers and young families. New homes are built for people who already own homes. Instead, we build condominiums. And condominiums, which are certainly an important part of our housing stock, are generally less amenable in terms of supporting and accommodating a growing family.
So, Robin Backen, if I may put this to you, I mean, there was a time when urban life, at least in urban legend, was considered, yes, exciting and feisty and zesty, but not necessarily a good thing for kids. You know, the Fresh Air Fund and all that. Get the kids out of the cities. Get them into the countryside. Are we dreaming about how fine city life should be for children? Is it maybe the suburbs are a more natural home for kids, or is that crazy?
Well, I think when a lot of those ideas came about a century ago, there was a great deal of concern about the need to protect children. And it was not just protecting children from labor, which, of course, was a big issue for children in the city mm-hmm. at the turn of the last century, but also protecting them from leisure. There was the rise of amusement parks and Nickelodeons and cheap theater, and a number of reformers believed that these were really detrimental to the development of children, and that, in fact, they should have fresh air, room to play. But at the turn of the last century, there was an emphasis on building parks and playgrounds in the city itself.
Now, you're talking 5 years ago.
No, I'm talking...
Or a century ago.
100 years
okay.
ago.
Okay, these centuries get confusing when you're in the noughts.
So, you know, the idea was to make the city itself a more livable place, so mm-hmm. that you build parks and bring elements of the natural world or of rural life into the city itself. Following World War II, we saw this process of massive suburbanization, and a lot of that had to do with federal programs that made it easier for returning veterans and for families to buy homes in the suburbs rather than, say, getting apartments or rehabilitating housing in the city. And so there was this perception that the suburbs or that natural areas in general were better for children, and that the cities could be dangerous. But in fact, today, you know, the kinds of dangers that many people believed plagued cities and were fearful in terms of thinking about children in mm-hmm. cities 100 years ago simply don't exist today.
They look pretty darn attractive very often.
Exactly.
Yes, please.
I wanted to talk a little more about housing stock, because we have virtually the same housing stock in Portland that we did when we had 80,000 students. So that housing stock supported a lot of children.
Have tastes changed? Is that it, Gary? Everybody wants a McMansion now?
Exactly. I think expectations of every child having his or her own bedroom is driving people to the suburbs. That, you know, we didn't tear down half our housing stock in the last 45 years.
Right.
And I guess the other question is, if we have a lot of people living alone in houses, do we really have an affordability problem? That, again, is a question about expectations.
I guess it all depends how much is in your wallet.
Well, and if you want a home to yourself, you know, then that makes a home less affordable if you're the only income generator in your household.
Let's so take another, if I may, I'd like to get another call before the break here, Gary. I've got Sean calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I'm an architecture student at the University of Kentucky, and we deal with urban issues a lot in our studio. And I was going to make the point that now, as different from 100 years ago, the image of the city as being a hustle and bustle and then the image of suburbia as being a safe place is sort of what we're trying to change. And I think through architecture, physically, by making places more available to people and by just planning the way we think about a city, that we can incorporate people back into a dense living environment and still give them that sense of safety that they crave from suburban life, because really it can be very wasteful to you know, decentralize.
Yeah, we hear you, Sean. Sean, in a nutshell, let me ask you, how do you do that concretely? How do you make a city or its housing stock more appealing to families?
Well, I think that you have to supply them with what they think they need. A lot of times people think that they need a yard or I mean, on simple levels, things like that. And I think by changing the way we think about housing complexes or you know, the way we lay out our city, make it more humane or maybe more to the scale of a human being or to a family as opposed to this commerce or industry-oriented downtown area.
Sean, that's terrific, and we hope you design all kinds of housing and community like that. Thanks very much for calling in from Lexington, Kentucky. Nicholas Retsinas, what about the housing stock? Do you see Americans' tastes simply having turned away from what the city has to offer in part?
Well, as we think of all have indicated, this trend of looking for the suburb, looking for that little house with the fence and the dog in the yard has been with us for a long, long time. I think it is really an insurmountable hill to think that we can attract families with children back in the cities. I think the strategy for cities is to think, how do you create environments so as these sort of families sort of grow in cities, they have a choice, and that choice includes the city. Unfortunately, in the past, that hasn't been a real choice. If you wanted a decent home in a decent neighborhood, that's often meant you had to live to the suburb. The revitalization of pockets of the city, we need to spread to the entire city so that these new families, when they reach that point, as Sabrina did, when their child turns 3 or 4 or 5, it's a legitimate option to stay in that neighborhood and stay in that community.
And if you can't draw families back into the city, is that homegrown surge that you might be able to nurture there enough to bring children back up in the population, make them a vital part of the urban population again?
Well, I think you can. I mean, there are some people who move back to cities. Again, they're not families with children, though. There are empty nesters. There are young people. Most of the young people who are moving into the cities in their early 20s come from the suburbs because they miss the hustle and bustle of the city. But again, it's not the environment where they see as one that's conducive to raising a family.
More questions here. Nicholas Ritsinas, please stand by. Robin Back and Gary Blackmer. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking tonight about cities without kids in a new era of urban revival. Is a home plus children more than most of America's new urban dwellers can afford? And are the hot new cities designed for well-heeled retirees and childless yuppies? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about cities without kids in a new era of urban revival. We're joined tonight from Portland, Oregon by Gary Blackmer. He's city auditor in Portland, Oregon, all over this problem. From Miami, Florida by Robin Backen, associate professor of history at the University of Miami. And from Providence, Rhode Island by Nicholas Ritsinas. He's director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. You can join us as well tonight. Have you felt the children disappearing from your city's streets? And which kids are still in America's hot cities now? And how are they doing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Glenn is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I've had experience living both in Chapel Hill and in Atlanta, Georgia. And I'd just like to observe that there are different preferences, as some of your hosts have said.
Mm-hmm.
So like when I lived in Atlanta in a small two-bedroom apartment in Midtown, it was mostly single people. There were some families with kids, but maybe that is the right place for singles to be living. And if you want a larger house with more square footage, it's going to be cheaper to get that out in the suburbs. So
are you suggesting that somehow the cities are the wrong place for kids to be living?
Oh, no, not at all. Just that if there are families who want yards and large housing space for their families, then they're going to want to be living out in the suburbs rather than the city.
Just kind of a simple formula there. Yeah. Yes, Glenn.
Well, I also live, actually not Chapel Hill, I live in Carrboro, a little town next to Chapel Hill,
mm-hmm.
which is the most densely populated local municipality in the state of North Carolina.
And why is that?
Well, it's near the university.
I see, yeah.
And so we actually have a policy here of trying to keep a very compact development, dense development.
Mm-hmm.
But we now have families with kids moving into houses at the edge of town, and they're wanting to have cul-de-sacs and a change in the way that the city is built. And so I'm seeing that we had some families in here with kids who wanted to live in a small town but very urban kind of feel to it. And now this other group is coming in, and they have a very different view of what the city should look like.
Give us the bigger house, give us the bigger yard and the cul-de-sac. Glenn, we've got it. It's really interesting. Robin Backen, how about it? We come back to preference here. And is it possible that we've just been conditioned to want that house, that yard, that cul-de-sac, and city life is just the wrong density?
Well, I think there has been an assumption, at least since World War II, that suburbs were better for families. As Gary mentioned when he interviewed a number of his constituents, that safety and security were primary issues that people cited. But in fact, one of the leading urban historians, Ken Jackson, has shown that, in fact, you have a higher chance of getting seriously injured or killed in an automobile accident, which is obviously more prevalent in the suburbs, than in any kind of crime or public transit accident in the city. But I do think that that whole notion that owning your own home with a white picket fence and a lawn is the epitome of the American dream is embedded in our culture, in our media. And so, you know, that's not to say that people don't really want that and that it does have certain advantages. But I think that there has been a very long perception among Americans, at least, that suburban living is better and healthier for families than urban living.
But a lot of these revived cities look like awfully attractive environments right now. Anthony's calling from Philadelphia. What do you think, Anthony?
Well, I think it's a great discussion. However, I think one of the pieces that are left out that needs to be discussed, both historically and currently, is when you talk about it, the whole housing issue in regards to race.
Yes.
The whole issue with white flight going back to World War II, when there was the migration in the urban cities and the movement of white flight. And we found the resegregation where most suburban schools are white and most urban schools are minority. That's an issue that has to be dealt with and discussed when we talk about revitalizing urban settings and making schools attractive to all, for all people.
Well, how do you see that, Anthony? Do you think there's still a racial factor to families moving out of the city? Of course, during time of school busing and the heyday of white flight, there was tons of that. Do you think that's still a primary factor now?
Well, as an educator myself who lives in an urban area and works in a suburban school, I live it every day. In Philadelphia, for instance, most of the kids are minority, and they have substandard education and funding compared to suburban districts, which because of property taxes. And to attract productive and middle-class and upper-class white families back in, a lot of those families, I think, will want to have some say in regards to where their kids go to school and how their kids are educated, and which is not the same kind of thing that happens in an urban city where they have the smaller opportunity to educate their kids at a smaller scale in suburban areas.
Right. Anthony, I'm so glad you bring this up. Thanks very much for it. Nicholas Ritsinas, what about the race factor here in the statistics? As children leave, are we talking about minority child populations as those who are still there?
I think the caller was really right on point. If you look at the data in American cities, while the last decade was a relatively good decade for American cities, in large measure that's because of immigration. Absent immigration, there are only two or three cities in the United States that would have gained population because of continuing white flight. Let's look at Boston as a case in point. While in Boston, the white population, the whites make up 55% of the adult population, they make up just 25% of the children. The minorities constitute 75% of the child population. And sadly and regretfully, race continues to be one of those intractable social issues in this country. And sometimes it's unspoken, but just because it's unspoken doesn't mean it's not very real.
I'm thinking here about how different Miami and Portland may be around this, but let me ask each of our guests, Robin, first to you. I mean, you're in a supremely multicultural environment there, but do you see a strong race factor in which kids live in the city today in Miami?
I think in Miami it's complicated by not just race, by also ethnicity, and particularly by immigration.
Yes.
Because and so I think this is why we have to also take into account not just race and ethnicity, but the ways in which they inform and link up with class. Because, for example, a lot of the revitalization that's happening in Miami is happening so that it appeals directly to a very elite segment of the population in terms of class position. It's less coded in terms of race because of the multinational character of the city. But, for example, there are little enclaves within this revitalization in downtown, one area, for example, known as Brickell Key, which is basically like your typical suburban gated community, except that it's in the city. So there are lots of kids and lots of amenities for children and for families, but you're basically on your own little island, literally, and separated from much of the rest of the city. So while you are downtown and you have that kind of vitality and excitement and dynamism of the city, at the same time, you're almost literally walled off or at least surrounded by water, so that the kinds of connections that we normally think of as being part of the urban experience don't necessarily happen.
And Gary Blackmer in Portland, how about it? As your population of children has declined, has it become had a more minority profile?
No, it's actually been the opposite. We've had more of a dispersion of minorities to the surrounding districts. I'm looking at one district right next to Portland's that had a 50% increase in students with English as a second language.
Has Portland, I really don't know, has Portland ever had a concentration of minorities in the city center?
No, we have about 15 to 20% minorities, and so it's been in those areas, though, that we've seen the gentrification taking place and dispersing them out to the lower cost housing in the surrounding areas.
So in your case, with your city's history and housing stock, it's pushing immigrant or minority families out of the city.
That's correct. I mean, they are coming in. This is a real gateway for international immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Russians and Hispanic and Asian and all sorts of cultures coming here, but they do bring large families with them, but then ultimately when they get jobs and get settled in, they will be moved out. They often move out to the suburban areas, and so we really are seeing a greater dispersion of minorities throughout the region.
Let me get one more call here. Janice is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Janice. You're on the air.
I'm actually calling to talk about Montreal, Quebec, where my granddaughter lives.
All right.
In the United States, we feel like we've got private affluence and public squalor.
We know the phrase.
Yeah, but in Canada, or in Quebec at least, there's much more investment in public facilities. So that, for instance, they put new playground equipment in all the parks. And I've spent quite a bit of time in the local park with mm-hmm. my granddaughter, and you see people of all ages enjoying the facilities. It's just such a different ethic. When she'll be able to walk to the bakery in a block and, you know, walk to school.
And it all looks like a good urban magnet to you.
Yeah, and I just think it's a great place to live.
Janice, thanks for drawing the comparison. Nick Retsinas, how about it? Is it a matter of public amenities in considerable portion here? We have the sense that in some cities amenities have improved in recent years.
They have improved in certain pockets. It's easy to overstate
yeah.
their improvement. There
yeah.
are some amazing sort of tales of revitalization in selected areas of city. But parts of cities are very, very crowded, and parts of cities are crowded with children. In some ways, as I've been listening to this conversation, the cities we are talking about and remember as being places for families and children still exist, but they're called inner-ring suburbs. They're now the areas around the fringes of cities.
Mm-hmm.
And the older cities that we remember are now homes for the very poor or the very well-to-do. And what's missing are those middle-income families with children.
Gary Blackman, let me ask you, just got a couple of minutes left here. What happens to schools when you have the drop in population like Portland's seen? You've still got a lot of people paying taxes, so does it leave more money per capita in the schools or less?
Well, we have state financing, and it's paid on a per-student basis. So the problem that we run into is that as we have fewer students in a school building, we end up spending more and more on the facility and less on teachers. So it becomes a real problem as neighborhoods have, you know, less and less density in terms of school children to sustain neighborhood schools that kids can walk to. So it's hard to attract families to schools when you're having to close schools down, and it's hard to rebuild, beautiful schools that can compete with the new suburban school when you are looking at closing schools and tearing them down. So the district
tough situation.
Yeah, it is. It's a frustrating one, but we really support schools. We've had a special tax to supplement what the state funding is, and 85% of the kids in the city do go to the city schools.
Robin, back in 20 seconds is all we've got here, but if you look 5 or 10 years out, what do you see? Cities with rich, poor, and few children, or a new trend?
Well, unfortunately, one of the larger issues that's confronting America today is the displacement of the middle class, and that's certainly the case in Miami. We basically see an evaporating middle class, a rise in poverty among certain groups, and then a rise in extreme wealth.
So it's kind of baked into those statistics. Robin Bakken, I'm sorry, but we're out of time at this end. We appreciate your being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Robin Bakken at the University of Miami. Nicholas Retsinas at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Gary Blackmer, City Auditor at Portland, Oregon. Gary, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. IMAX theaters in several southern cities have decided not to run a new movie on volcanoes because it refers to evolution. An IMAX theater director in Charleston, South Carolina, explained her decision, saying, "We've got to pick a film that's going to sell in our area. Many people here believe in creationism, not evolution." The IMAX retreat marks one more step in a battle between science and religion that's been raging everywhere from American science classrooms to Terry Schiavo's bedside. But are science and religion necessarily at odds? Not according to Nobel laureate Charles Townes, co-inventor of the laser and professor at the University of California, Berkeley. This month, Townes was awarded the $1.5 million Templeton Prize for his work in bridging science and religion. In this radio diary, Charles Townes explains why, in his view, science and religion are not as opposed to each other as many people make them out to be.
Consider what science is all about. Science is an attempt to understand our universe, what it's made of, how it works. And what is religion? Well, religion is an attempt to understand the purpose and meaning of our universe. Now, if the universe has a meaning or purpose, then that must affect its structure and how it works. So the two must be closely related. If there's any meaning at all to our universe, then that must relate to its structure and vice versa. And so in the long run, if we understand both completely, then they ought to come together. Many scientists felt, well, there's never any beginning to the universe. It can't have a beginning. That was part of the divergence of a century ago. Nowadays, however, we have discovered that actually the universe did have a beginning. It had a beginning about 13 billion years ago. There was a unique situation in our universe as it began to explode and develop and so on. Now, developed over a long period of time, nevertheless, it did have that beginning. And as we understand more and more science, we see somewhat more and more parallelism and suggests things which suggest religious point of view, such as the fact that our universe has to be designed in a very special way. That is, the laws of physics has to be very special in order for us to be here at all. This is a very unusual universe, highly improbable. And how did it happen? So it's that kind of thing which are beginning to bring the two together a bit. Intelligent design does not disprove evolution at all, and depends on how you use it. Now, these people use intelligent design to say, well, evolution was designed. Well, actually, I think the physical scientists talk about intelligent design as, well, the laws of physics, the basic laws of physics that produce our atoms and so on, all of those, that's very, very special. And how in the world did it happen? And we've used the terminology intelligent design. Certainly, it's an unusual design, at least. But intelligent design has been misused to try to prove this kind of an absolutist point of view of religion. Both sides are somewhat guilty. We generally think of a fundamentalist religionist. Fundamentalist religion as being absolute, that we know exactly what the situation is, and that's that. Nothing else can be right. But some scientists have taken the same point of view, that their science laws, this is exactly what's right, nothing else is right, and so on. Both are very narrow-minded, in my view. I think we have to recognize in all of these things that there's a great deal we don't understand. We understand some things, and science has developed remarkably over the last 100 years or so. But nevertheless, there are some very deep problems we don't understand at all. We have to recognize that, and we have to be open-minded, both in science and in religion.
Charles Townes is professor at the University of California in Berkeley. He is co-inventor of the laser, and in 1964, he shared the Nobel Prize for Physics. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.